Now, the analog of what you were hearing about in the field theory lecture is the electron-photon interaction. And I'm going to spend a moment talking about that. What happens is that there is a crystal lattice. And there are electrons moving through that crystal lattice. The electrons move through the crystal lattice, interact with the shaking up and back of the crystal lattice. If you have a field psi adjunct, not psi bar, but psi adjunct for the electrons, then you have a Hamiltonian in which there is something that looks like a electron-phonon interaction, psi adjoint psi. There's a sum over spin indices from 1 to 2. And then in the middle, there is something representing the phonon field. The phonon field has wave vector k and has energy h bar minus of k. You draw a diagram just like the one that's sort of hidden there. An electron comes in, electron goes out, the electron scatters. I guess I drew my diagrams 90 degrees off of the diagrams of particle physics. That doesn't make a big deal difference. Electron comes in with a momentum p, scatters off of an electron with momentum p prime, goes into q. That's not the one I want. Electron comes in with momentum p, goes off with momentum p prime. In the meantime, it emits a phonon with momentum q. What we want to do is calculate what this process does for the derivative in time of the electron probability density, f of p, q, and t. What you get is a term which looks like what you might have expected from the particle physics case. Namely, first you get a amplitude squared. Then you get an f from the electron coming in, a 1 minus f from the electron going out. And then there are two possible processes. If you're absorbing this phonon, you put in an NQ there for the phonon you absorb. If you're emitting the phonon, you have FP times 1 plus NQ, the number, the amplitude for the emission of the phonon, and FP prime. You then put in energy momentum conserving delta function, and you have the same story that you had in particle physics. I will write the energy and momentum conserving delta functions for this term first, and then for that one, you get a delta function of p minus p prime plus h plus q. Particle absorbs a phonon. No, this is the emission of a phonon with a momentum q. So p turns into p prime plus q. Energy of an electron with momentum p turns into the energy with p prime plus h bar omega sub q. That's this process, the one in which an emission of a photon occurs. This is the process in which an absorption of a photon occurs. That has an NQ, has a flip in the signs of the momentum and the energy, and is just about what you might expect. This describes the plus dot, 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 is the derivative of epsilon t with respect to p times the derivative with respect to r of f, plus another term which you know, and I don't have space to write it. This is the real process that goes along. That is, the electron, as drawn here, the electron comes in, a photon comes in, the photon is absorbed, the electron goes out. There's also a virtual process, a process in which this thing appears in an energy denominator and changes the wave function of the electron. I'm not going to write that down, but that's important also, for example, for the development of superconductivity in metals. The story is essentially exactly the same with a few changes in what you do with indices in order to, in particular, the spinner indices, in order to describe the difference between relativistic and non-relativistic situations. The physics is all the same. Mathematics is very similar. I'm going to back one, see where we started from. Where we ended up last time was so we were looking at the same thing for electrons, any Fermi particle scattering off of any other Fermi particle. Does anybody know where my stick might be hiding? I don't need it, I guess. Thank you.
Rescue.
Okay. We write down an analog of the Boltzmann equation, time derivative of the number of electrons in the, with momentum in the neighborhood of p, position in the neighborhood of r at time t. We then look at a process in which we scatter from pq to p prime q prime. We put in the probabilities of finding an electron with momentum p and another electron of momentum q to do that scattering. We put in 1 minus f of p prime in order to represent the fact that you have to find an empty state in order for the electron to scatter from p into p prime. 1 minus f of q prime, you have to find an empty state for the electron to scatter from q to q prime. You put in a scattering rate and integrate over everything you've ever heard of. Do the same process backwards, again with 1 minus f of p, 1 minus f of error. This should be a q, sorry. Yes, this should be a q. Okay, the formulas are the same. What goes on is somewhat different. There is a very low scattering rate at low temperatures. That's because in order to scatter, you have to find, first of all, another guy whose energy is within a kT of the Fermi surface to scatter off of. You have to find empty states to scatter into. And those empty states have to be within kT of the Fermi surface again. And then you have, because of the energy conservation delta function, which what I just said, it gives you 2 conditions rather than 3, and you end up with a scattering rate which is proportional to t squared. It says someplace, it says that someplace on the slide. When we look at the effect of this term, we discover
that the effect of this term is to drive ourselves into a situation of local thermodynamic equilibrium. If we demand that this be zero, namely that this part with the correct f of q there balance against this part, then what we are in effect demanding is put the eraser down someplace. Help. Well, here's the eraser. What we were in effect demanding is that f of p over 1 minus f of p is something which is reflected by conserved quantities. It's e to the minus beta times the energy. That will do it. We can put in any mu that we want. That will continue to give us the, something in which this term cancels against this term. And we could even put in a p dot v term. These terms, mu, v, and beta, could all depend on space and time, if we cared to have it so. Yes?
I don't know how to see from the equation at the top why the scattering constricted to the modes that are within KT at the Fermi surface.
I'm sorry, the traffic confused me. Say it again, please.
I'm not sure.
You don't know how to see from the equations that what?
That the scattering only involves modes that are within KT at the Fermi surface.
Okay. Let me assume I'm not sure I know how to do it either, so I'm going to do it on the fly. Let me assume that I have this guy within KT of the Fermi surface. Now, I can't have this guy. If this guy is real deep in, here's the Fermi surface. I want this guy somewhere here within KT of that Fermi surface, and the energy goes up like that. If this guy is way down here, very low energies, then we have an energy which is a value of E minus mu, which is of order KT, a value of E minus mu, which is very negative. And I have to find empty states to scatter into. If this guy is way down there, I'm not going to find empty states. That is, the energy of this guy plus the energy of this guy is a large negative number. And these guys are only empty for positive numbers. And so I'm not going to find it. So this guy has to be up someplace around here. If this guy is up somewhere in this band of KT around the Fermi surface, then the total energy I get out is going to be of order KT. That is, the total E minus mu value will be of order KT. And then I can find E minus mu's of order KT there and there, in which these guys are unoccupied and hence not equal to zero. I've only said the same thing again, so let me try to say it for you once more with equations.
F is zero. Only for one minus F is zero.
I have E minus mu sub P plus E minus mu sub Q equal to E minus mu sub P prime plus E minus mu sub Q prime. in order that I have the X non-zero, this number cannot be too large. If this number is large, then the Fs will be essentially zero. So this thing has to be less than or of the order of kT. Similarly for this guy, has to be less than or of the order of kT. Opposite is true here. For this guy to be empty, I have to have this energy to be bigger than or of the order of kT. And the same here, bigger than or of the order of kT. Since P is at my disposal, I will demand this. I'm just going to look at states that obey this. Then I have three more conditions. That three more conditions should give me T cubed, except that one of the conditions is eaten up by a delta function. It only gives me T squared. My hands have never left my arms. I think this is the correct version of the calculation. The thing works the same in the opposite sense, but we have to remember that there is an error in this. What we have is that only particles in the neighborhood of kT, of the neighborhood of the Fermi surface, are active, and neighborhood means within kT of the Fermi surface. Okay. We have a hierarchy of relaxation times in this kind of problem, and I should tell you a little bit about that hierarchy. So let me get rid of this. And no, I should tell you. Okay. If this particle with momentum p had a tremendous energy, I wouldn't have had this set of k. I wouldn't have had this set of conditions. That is, if it had an energy, let me be specific. At room temperature, kT is a 40th of an electron volt. Chemical potential is about 40,000 electron volts for a metal. Big difference. If epsilon p were of order that, then I could easily have all the scatterings I want. I wouldn't have these conditions that I wanted to have the kT's within the kT's close to the energies close to the Fermi surface within kT of the Fermi surface. I would get a scattering rate which is of order 1 in the units of in which Q is equal to 1. So I get a rapid scattering. Because of the conditions I just told you, the scattering rate goes down by a factor of t squared, or kT squared, from the rapid scattering for the high energy guy. The scattering rate for guys of high energy is rapid. The scattering rate for guys of energy of order kT with the Fermi surface is down by a factor of kT squared from that rapid scattering rate. And then you can get, in fact, slower relaxation, because once you reach local equilibrium, once you get to this, then you have situations in which the entire scattering term disappears, and you have to work
with the terms on the left-hand side of the Boltzmann equation. Those terms on the left-hand side of the Boltzmann equation give you a situation in which the frequencies, that is the time derivative, the frequencies, are of order spatial gradients. And if things are varying slowly in space, you can get slow relaxation in the system. So you have at least three different relaxation times. The time that it takes for the time between typical scattering events, the time between typical scattering events as reduced by the factor of kT squared, which is required because only particles near the Fermi surface are really active, and then the much slower scattering rate yet that occurs because there are transport processes in the system. Among the transport processes are sound waves that can have frequencies as low as one cycle per second, whereas the energy, if frequencies corresponding to the Fermi energy in a metal correspond to 10 to the minus 16 seconds, and down by kT squared is a factor of several hundred squared below that. That's crazy. I'm sorry. Excuse me, too early in the morning. The chemical potential is several eV. Not 40,000, but there's still a major factor between mu and kT. The scattering rate is down by a factor of kT squared from the scattering rate corresponding to the chemical potential. And the sound waves can have as low frequency as we want. This hierarchy of relaxations is rather characteristic of any condensed matter system, and is in fact a characteristic, as I mentioned at the end of the last hour, of systems in particle physics as well. In particle physics, we have the Planck scale, which gives us very high frequencies. We have the scale of the particles that we observe, like the proton and the neutron. And then we have the scale of masses that correspond, say, to the neutrino, which is much, much smaller and are produced by conservation laws to some extent and by weaker interactions. Then at the end of the last hour, we went over to bosons. The bosons have an equation of motion which is essentially the same as the equation for the fermions. You have a distribution function, f of p, r, and t. You have the same structure on the left-hand side of a Boltzmann equation. You have the same scattering processes. Correct there. You have the same scattering processes going on. A particles will scatter from states of momentum p and q into states of momentum p prime and q prime. The opposite scattering will occur. Particles will scatter from states of momentum p prime and q prime into momentum p and q. There is, however, a major difference between the fermions and the bosons. In the fermion case, what you have is minus signs, where I have these red plus signs. The minus signs reflect the fact that for fermions, once the state is occupied, you cannot put more particles in it. For bosons, quite the opposite is true. Once you have particles in the state, more and more particles want to scatter into the state. If you look at it in terms of the quantum mechanics, the minus sign for fermions is because you have anti-symmetric wave functions and then some destructive interference. The plus sign for bosons is because you have symmetric wave functions and constructive interference. In any case, we know that this is the right result. There is more scattering when the final states, when the final single particle states are occupied than when they're empty. This is a result that was first pointed out. This 1 plus F structure is a result which was first pointed out to us by Einstein and by Planck. The 1 and the F are reflectively described as spontaneous and stimulated emission. If there's nobody in the state, then you have a spontaneous emission process in which you can nonetheless land in the state. If there are more particles in the state, you get an enhanced emission process called stimulated emission, in which more particles want to land in the state. What Einstein did was put together this 1 plus F structure. He put it together because, for he pointed out, this is a fermion result, that for bosons, F over 1 plus F would, if you took into account the structure here, give us an, if you demanded local equilibrium, give us an e to the minus beta e minus mu plus p dot v as before. And that this was exactly the structure you got from equilibrium statistical mechanics for bosons, as this is the structure you get from equilibrium statistical mechanics for fermions. Einstein wanted to get this structure out, and he pointed out that this structure in the dynamics would give this structure in the statics, and he demanded that we get the dynamics and the statics being consistent with one another. What I described very briefly for the phonons gives us a situation in which the dynamics of the electrons and the phonons give us a correct equilibrium description of the number of phonons and the number of electrons as we would get it out of equilibrium statistical mechanics. So this is sort of the end of the description of the dynamics. We have a dynamics following upon the work of Einstein and Planck and of Boltzmann, originally Boltzmann, which gives us a way of understanding how the equilibrium statistical mechanics arises. It is not truly a derivation of the equilibrium statistical mechanics, because a true derivation would require us to have an understanding of both all of the cases in which we get the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution, and also of all the cases in which we don't quite get the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution, because we get a frozen behavior of a different kind. Are there questions or comments about the dynamics?
Because we're going to go on to another topic here. My next bunch of lectures is going to look a little bit different from the last bunch. The last bunch was prepared for you all to set up as a pedagogical kind of thing appropriate for a bunch of students who might, some of them know a lot of statistical mechanics, and some of them know practically no statistical mechanics. I'm going to now be talking about phase transitions and mean field theories. You haven't heard a word about mean field theories, and since much of what is actually done in statistical mechanics, and in fact particle physics too, is in terms of mean field theories, that's a worthwhile thing to do. However, this is about fast transitions and mean field theories, was put together equally aimed at physicists and philosophers of science. That means there's a little bit more, there's a little bit more wordy in the lectures up until now. I will focus, however, on the parts that aren't so wordy and tell you how to do calculations. Words here that come along are singularity, order parameter, mean field theory, and variational method. You've seen some of them before. In particular, you've heard a lot about variational methods with a description of how variations work in both the Lagrangian and in the free energy. The traditional concept of correlation lengths, that'll come up again, you've seen it before. So there are ideas like mean field theory, phase transitions, and universality, and variational methods of scale, which will come up. But first, we start with a beautiful picture. Matter exists in different phases, different states of matter with qualitatively different properties. This picture shows ice and water vapor and plain old liquid water. And what you're supposed to do is imagine the phase differences, the differences in phase between frozen water and liquid water and vapor water, and think about the phase transitions that might occur, describing how these different states of matter arise. Here's a phase diagram from water, copied off the web like many other things. This phase diagram for water shows temperature here going from 200 degrees Kelvin to 800 degrees Kelvin, and a pressure here going from high pressures to very low pressures on a logarithmic scale of pressure and a linear scale of temperature. Along here is the different phases of water which occur under these different conditions. On this side, at the low temperature side, there are a whole bunch of phases of ice. Ice has at least seven different phases and phase transitions which connect the different phases. We're not going to be talking much about that. Each phase here, however, has a different structural property of the ice, and these are transitions between different structures of the ice. Here's a transition between a solid phase, ice one, so to speak, and the liquid phase of water. All along this line is a transition between an ice phase and a liquid phase. Here is a transition between a liquid phase and a vapor phase. The liquid phase and the vapor phase are qualitatively similar to one another. The ice phase and the liquid phase are qualitatively different from one another. The ice has a crystal structure underlying it. It therefore has a broken rotational symmetry. It has no rotational symmetry. The liquid phase has a rotational symmetry, as does the vapor phase. The difference between liquid and vapor is that this is a higher density, this is a lower density, and there's a jump in density as you cross this phase boundary. Here's a place called the triple point where ice and vapor and liquid come together. All along here, there is a liquid-vapor phase transition. That liquid-vapor phase transition ends at a critical point. That critical point has the properties of the liquid and the properties of the vapor become indistinguishable from one another. Here, there's a big jump in density. The jump gets smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller until the jump in density is zero at this point. The qualitative similarity between the phases of liquid and vapor is reflected by the fact that you can make a continuous transition going around the critical point, going from any portion of the liquid to any portion of the vapor phase. You cannot do the analogous thing. There is no continuous transformation which will take you from liquid to solid. Here I want to emphasize
that there is basic physics in phase transition ideas, and that condensed matter physics has basic physics in it. Ideas derived from phase transitions and other intellectual products of condensed matter physics are crucial for many branches of modern science and for modern theoretical physics. You can recognize the language of a commercial message. The basic ideas include phase transitions always require an infinite number of degrees of freedom. That might be something that's sort of new to you. Let me tell you what this is about. We're going to go over it slow. Gibbs defined a phase transition as a mathematical singularity in the thermodynamic statistical properties of the material. Gibbs also proved, and I'll prove for you, a theorem that says such mathematical singularities never occur unless there's a possibility of some infinity someplace in the many-particle system. The most likely infinity, the one that occurs almost always, is an infinite number of degrees of freedom. A phase transition happens in a system with n equals infinity almost always, and not in a system with n different from infinity. Infinity, it says here, may come either from something that happens over an infinite period of time, over an infinite amount of space, or in the development of some infinite complexity within the system. I just told you that an infinite amount of space is what usually happens. The structure of space and time are important determinants of what we see happen. That is, an infinite amount of space is not only what's necessary, we need to understand the structure of space. The dimensions of space matter as to whether the system in question repeats itself infinitely often. That is, a space which periodically repeats itself is not good enough to get a phase transition. What you need is a space in which things are different at different points. The topology of the surrounding space and of the created structures are quite important. Question, yes?
If we need an infinite number of degrees of freedom or infinite space or something, well, in real life, like a block of ice is not infinitely big, or so how do we ever get phase transition? We never really have infinite degrees of freedom.
Yes, there are many things that we have in physics that never occur really. Galileo told us that we should think about the equations of motion of frictionless stuff. That's what classical mechanics is all about. Frictionless stuff ain't there. There is no frictionless stuff. Everything involves friction. If I set this pool table, this pool stick sliding across the floor, it will stop. The balls on the pool table come to a stop. Those things both violate classical mechanics. Classical mechanics is wrong. It's not in the real world. The world in which physics occurs, I told you this was a philosopher, the world in which physics occurs is not the real world, it's our minds. The frictionless stuff is not in the real world, it's in our mind. The infinite thing in which phase transitions occur is not in a glass of water, it is in our picture in our mind of what an infinite body of water would do.
But I've seen a phase transition before.
How do you know you've seen it? Gibbs says the phase transition involves a singularity in the properties of the material. How do you know that you've seen a singularity?
Well, I've seen water freeze. I mean, I've seen ice melt.
You've seen water look somewhat different from the way it looked when it was liquid. In fact, if you have a large system, the thing looks very much like it is having a phase transition. However, the mathematical properties of phase transition only occur in an infinite system. Yes?
So is there some kind of better definition of what a phase transition is that makes it, like, have something to do with reality?
Is there a better definition of classical mechanics? But has laser have something to do with reality?
Are those two questions the same?
Yes, they are. Because classical mechanics is friction-free motion.
Okay. So is the answer no, is what you're saying?
My claim, you're just beating me up for things which might interest philosophers. My claim is that physics is not something that happens entirely in the real world. It is an extrapolation of the real world produced by our thought processes. It is not a new idea, it's not my idea. Plato more or less described the world in similar terms, although he didn't use the word physics. Plato said that the world we see with our eyes is a pale reflection of the world we know that exists with our minds. Physics is a different thing from anything that happens in an actual object. Let me give you another example. I am happy to talk about a perfect solid. It is a solid which includes no defects in its structure. I will tell you about the electrical properties of a perfect solid. I'll tell you about the phase transitions that occur in a perfect solid. Perfect solids don't exist in nature. You go out and walk through mountains and you see solids, but they are melanges, mixtures of different things. They have many, many defects in their crystal structure. And they're not perfect solids. In order to get a more or less perfect solid, you take silicon and you do wonderful things to it, involving the expenditure of lots of effort to refine it and make it more crystalline and perfect. The notion of a perfect crystal is the notion of an object which doesn't really exist but can be approximated by the things that humankind can do to silicon. You object to my view of the phase transition as something that only occurs in an infinite system. Why are you willing to work with a frictionless body? You know that they don't exist. Okay, we should think about that. At least I have provoked you, as I was intended to think about what the nature of physics is and the nature of what we do as physicists. Okay. I start again from J. Willard Gibbs. A phase transition is a singularity in thermodynamic behavior. I assert once again that this only occurs in an infinite system. Let me go to Ehrenfest, who is a more pragmatic character, who is more practical in some sense. Ehrenfest pointed out that a first-order phase transition, that is like the one that takes a discontinuous jump between liquid and gas, is a discontinuous jump in thermodynamic quantities. He classified phase transitions as first order, second order, third order, fourth order, fifth order, etc. His second order phase transition had continuous thermodynamic quantities, but infinities and derivatives of thermodynamic quantities. We now classify phase transitions somewhat differently as first order phase transitions and critical behavior, higher order phase transitions. We make the distinction, again, between first order and higher order phase transitions. I'll show it to you in a magnetic phase diagram. Now, one of the things that I don't emphasize in this picture is that real ferromagnets are different from what I show you in the picture. A real piece of iron contains many micro domains, or not so micro, domains that are visible under a microscope, which is not really very small by modern standards, in which particles are aligned, have their spin aligned. The next domain will have a different alignment, and the next domain will have a different alignment. I do not emphasize in this picture, nor in my discussion of ferromagnets,
that this grainy behavior is the true behavior of ferromagnets, and it's the true ground state of ferromagnets. Instead, I have in my mind a perfect ferromagnet, in which a whole crystal is lined up in the same direction. This picture is a description of a perfect ferromagnet. I cannot get a perfect piece of iron ferromagnet that is very large. It just doesn't work. It's not the ground state. I can get a reasonable approximation of a reasonably perfect liquid, and that's why it's easier to talk for some purposes about a liquid. But let me look at this phase diagram again. Here's a phase diagram for a piece of iron. Temperature goes this way, zero temperature is down here, high temperatures is here. This is 600 degrees Kelvin, or 600 degrees centigrade or so, in which there's a critical point in the behavior of iron. Iron has a first-order phase transition, a jump in the magnetization at zero field. If we start out with a little bit of magnetic field going this way, and we bring the magnetic field down, we can get a jump in the magnetization, which the magnetization jumps to a point in the opposite direction. The reason that this jump occurs is that there is a tendency. There's a tendency for the spins within the iron to point in the same direction. They have a lower energy if they point in the same direction than if they point in different directions. And so pair by pair by pair, the spins in the iron tend to line up until a domain containing many particles, not the full 10 to the 23rd particles of a real hunk of iron, but 10 to the 15 particles, have their spins mostly lined up in the same direction. There is a discontinuous jump as the directions of those domains within the iron change. That discontinuous jump is very real. You can hear it. You attach a microphone to a piece of iron, and you change the magnetic field. As you change the magnetic field, the direction of the magnetization in the microdomains changes, and you get clicks, sounds that occur called Barkhausen noise from the changes in dimension and direction of the magnetization. So there is a jump in the magnetization at zero field that occurs all along this line. That jump disappears at 600 degrees centigrade, or whatever that critical temperature is. And above that critical point, there is no such jump in the magnetization. I'll show you a picture a little later which shows you how these things happen. But I want to remind you that there is a real difference. Not that you needed reminding. You know that there's a real difference, even between small hunks of water. Here's a snowflake, maybe that size. This is a crystal of water, and you can clearly see the directions of the crystal axis. This is a splash on the surface of a piece of water. You can clearly see in this, in the existence of the surface, the difference between the vapor phase and the liquid phase of water. And you can clearly see in your mind, as you imagine what happens after this splash, the flow properties of water, liquid water, in comparison to the rigidity of the ice. First order phase transition involves a discontinuous jump. I'll get you in a sec, or rather, why don't I get you right now? This is just sort of bull.
It's about the snowflake. So the snowflake's completely symmetrical, right? So how does one side of the snowflake know to look exactly like the other side when it's forming?
Mm-hmm. Okay, that is an interesting question. How do you think one side of the I didn't invent the snowflake. There it is. It's real. Depending on what you define as real. But it seems to be real. How does this know about that? How do you think it knows?
I have no idea. I don't know.
How does one side of your body know to look like the other side? You're symmetric too. Same instructions.
No, but well, that one is going to have a gene, isn't it?
It's kind of a cell or something.
I will tell you how it happens. This whole lecture is sort of about the whole subject of phase transitions. Indeed, the whole subject of condensed matter physics. Indeed, sort of all of physics is about the answer to that question. How do we get different phases of matter with different kinds of correlations between the behavior at different points? That's, as you point out, an interesting question.
Excuse me, sir. Don't they explain the formation of snowflakes with cellular automata models these days?
I'm sorry, I'm not understanding the words. Don't they explain the formation of snowflakes
with cellular automata models for condensation or
okay. A cellular automaton model is a computer program. Right. That is, it basically takes into account atomic interactions in some approximate way, and repeatedly does the effect of atomic interactions. Atoms take into account the effect of atomic interactions, and repeatedly take into account the effects of atomic interactions. To say the cellular automaton model produces a snowflake is not to explain the snowflake. It is just to illustrate it once more. A computer program is no better than nature if we don't understand it with our heads. Physics occurs in our heads. That's the point I'm trying to make here. Okay. Since you asked the question, I will tell you how information is transferred from one place to another, and then tell you that that's what the whole lecture is about. So you have these two atoms sitting next to one another, and they know that they want to orient themselves so that the atoms of water look like a little toy with directional properties. They know that they want to orient themselves with respect to one another like that. And then the next atom over wants to orient itself like that, and the next one like that, and the next one like that. And through a process of orientation with neighbors very close by, neighboring interactions extend over the entire range of the system. Now, many people in Anglo-Saxon cultures as children play a game called more or less secrets. You whisper to your neighbor a secret, and then your neighbor whispers to his or her neighbor the secret, and then the neighbor whispers again. And the question is, as you go across the room, does the secret change? Do you transfer the information faithfully? Here, the information you're whispering is of the orientation. The orientation information is not carried here, it is carried there. And the whole subject of phase transitions, indeed the whole subject of condensed matter physics, as I said, is about how information is carried from one place to another inside a material. And what you're learning in the field theory course, for example, is how the interactions work between different pieces of the vacuum relatively close to one another, or different particles, again, when they get relatively close to one another. That information is carried across the entire space and time in order to make the entire structure of space and time. And that's what physics is about for space-time structure. Here is how the I'll tell you a little more about how the information is carried here, but that's what this thing is about. Okay. So you made me give up all my secrets at the beginning, but I'm not going to stop talking just because you made me give up my secrets.
A first order phase transition involves a discontinuous jump in some statistical variable. The discontinuous property is called the order parameter. Each phase transition has its own order parameter. The possible order parameters range over a tremendous variety of physical properties. These properties include the density within a liquid gas transition, the magnetization, the direction of the magnetization in a ferromagnet, the size of the connected cluster in a percolation transition. We haven't talked about that, and we won't. The condensate wave function is superfluid or superconductor. Superfluid or superconductor are extremely interesting things in which an entire wave function becomes a macroscopic, many particle involved, statistical variable. In fact, we already talked about that in a superfluid. I pointed out to you that in the low temperature behavior of helium-4, the macroscopic number of particles was described by the same mode, the same single particle state. That makes a condensate wave function, that is to say, a single particle wave function, describe a macroscopic number of particles. A continuous transition occurs when the discontinuity in the jump approaches zero. We will understand about the jump. The jump is really the interesting thing. But we'll understand about the jump by looking at its disappearance. Often one understands better about things when one looks at them as they appear and disappear. This section is about the development, this section of the course is about the development of what is called the mean field theory as a basis for a partial understanding of phase transitions and the order parameters that we're talking about. Okay, now I'm going to convince you, I hope, that the phase transitions indeed involve a mathematical singularity. For example, we have talked lots about a problem defined by an Ising model, in which a Hamiltonian divided by Boltzmann constant times temperature is some coupling constant times the sum over nearest neighbors of Ising variables taking on the value plus or minus 1, and a magnetic field times the sum over all sites of an Ising variable. The free energy is defined by minus F over KT is the logarithm of the sum over all of these spin variables of the exponential of the Hamiltonian divided by KT. That's what we said on day one, day zero. You knew that, most of you knew that before you walked into the course. You also know that by looking at it, that the Hamiltonian is a smooth function of K and H. Technically, the description is that the Hamiltonian is a real analytic function of K and H. All the derivatives of the Hamiltonian with respect to K and H exist. In fact, the derivatives, the second derivatives are all zero. All the derivatives exist and they are smooth. If the free energy is defined as the logarithm of the sum of a bunch of exponentials. Theorem. The logarithm, well, first of all, the sum of a bunch of exponentials of a smooth function is a smooth function. Real analytic in the mathematical language. All of its derivatives exist. If we have a sum of exponentials of real stuff, its logarithm gives you no singularity. Multiplying by KT gives you no singularity. F is, according to the theorem, an analytic function of K and H, real analytic. All of its derivatives exist and are continuous. That's a theorem. Gibbs, however, insisted that we define a phase transition as a mathematical singularity in a system. In our first example of a system, we can show clearly, without ambiguity, that no mathematical singularities occur. How do we then get a mathematical singularity? Well, the answer is simple but disconcerting. The answer is that we never get a mathematical singularity so long as there are a finite number of terms in these sums. A finite sum of exponentials of smooth functions is a smooth function. We will only get singularities like jumps, like changes in behavior, when we go to the limit of an infinite system. The mathematics here is nothing that you can argue with. There's lots and lots and lots of people found this mathematics disconcerting. Uhlenbeck describes a conference in 1937 in which famous people, including Debye, a good statistical mechanic, and Uhlenbeck, another good statistical mechanic, came together and debated whether phase transitions were a consequence of equilibrium statistical mechanics. The debate was because of this issue. They had a vote, and why not have a vote? Debye, the most famous person there, voted against phase transitions being a consequence of equilibrium statistical mechanics. He voted incorrectly, as I think I will argue to you, as I will argue to you. Phase transitions are a consequence of equilibrium statistical mechanics. They occur in an infinite system, and they only occur in an infinite system. The next thing I'm going to do for you is define a sort of approximate theory called mean field theory, which it gives phase transitions. Yes?
System and you conclude that from this system it is in C is finite, the field there's no phase transition. So is it, are you sure that all the systems that you can think of will have that property?
That's a good question. You might argue that a real liquid is much more complicated than an Eisenmodel. A real liquid has, when you bring its molecules close together, an infinitely large interaction. A real liquid has a continuous symmetry. A real liquid, that is, the Eisenmodel is all discrete stuff, a real liquid has positions being continuous variables. There are other differences, they don't come to mind at the moment, but those are two very important differences. Now we go to experiment or compare theory and experiment. We look at computer simulations based on Isaac Hamiltonian, and we compare the computer simulations with the results of measurements done on real liquids. If the computer simulations of the Isaac system look like the behavior of the real liquid to some extent, then you would argue that the Isaac system is a good model, the final word for it, model, is a good model for the real liquid. No argument of that kind can be fully convincing. Lots of arguments of that kind, lots of evidence in that direction might be helpful in convincing someone. Maybe you don't want to be convinced. I will present to you arguments. I will tell you some of the arguments I know about and some of the arguments that I've heard about. I will try to convince you at the end that an Ising system is very much like a real liquid. But if you want to stand with Mr. DeBye, Professor DeBye, and not believe it, you're quite welcome not to believe. It's okay. Science is always provisional. You don't have to believe anything in science. However, here are sort of simple-minded calculations, which I will start out with in order to get us into the subject. I will start out by saying that I will take a system which I can certainly do nicely. One Ising spin. Write down its Hamiltonian, which we've seen before, and calculate using statistical mechanics the average of that spin. Then I will follow two workers who are intelligent and careful scientists from ages ago, Pierre Weiss and Pierre Curie. I will make an argument something like theirs, although they didn't actually make it just the same way that I'm making it. I will start out with an Ising model and try to use this one spin argument to derive a set of formulas which might apply and give us phase variations. Let's focus on one spin, this one right here, that at the point R, and ask what is there that this spin feels. It first of all feels this magnetic field that we apply from outside. It secondly feels the sum of its neighbors, a term like coupling times the sum of all of the nearest neighbors to this guy. This is the thing that this, these are the things that in equilibrium statistical mechanics, this one spin is supposed to notice. And now I'm going to do something outrageous, but something which has been done for many years, and to get some idea of what happens in the phase transition. I'm going to be taking the one spin theory and applying the same idea that I used in the one spin theory to the many spins. This approach is called mean field theory, and since it's more than 120 years old, of course it must not. I'm not going to say it has to be right, I almost said that, but it's an old thing that we use for lots of times and have lots of experience with. So we focus on one spin, and this one spin sees an effective Hamiltonian, which is its magnetic field, times the sum of its nearest neighbors, times, I'm going to make an approximation. It feels not the actual value of the Ising spins, but the average value of the Ising spins, which are its nearest neighbors. I can point out a theorem which says that the approach that I'm going to give you is accurate as the becomes accurate, more and more accurate, as the number of nearest neighbors gets larger and larger. In particular, it is more and more accurate as the dimension of the lattice gets higher and we get more and more nearest neighbors, or as the interactions become more and more long range and we get more effective nearest neighbors. Whatever that is, I'm going to replace the average spin of the nearest, the spin of the nearest neighbors by its average, and say that that doesn't depend on position in the lattice. So the effective spin on the effective field on this guy, HEFF, effective field, is the original magnetic field plus the coupling plus the times the number of nearest neighbors times the average spin of the neighbors. And I will say that the average of this sigma r is the hyperbolic tangent up here of the effective spin of the effective field produced by the applied field and of the, all of the neighboring stuff. I'm going to go on and do this.
I'm going to form all of the consequences of this, or many of the consequences of this, and take it seriously. I will tell you that you all have done this many times, probably, in your electricity and magnetism course. Do you remember many of you in the electricity and magnetism course talking about B and H and D and E? Certainly in Landau and Lifshitz, electromagnetism stuff. But it's sitting there throughout everybody's electromagnetism course. B and E are the real, honest-to-goodness fields at the particles that whose motion we're looking at. H and D are the fields applied from outside. H and D is like that H. B and E are like this, the total field produced by all of the other guys. We say that an electron moving through a metal moves as a free particle through the field B, and we calculate its behavior as it moves through that free particle, through that field. We're doing something exactly like this in the electromagnetism of materials. Since we've done it in the past, of course, it must be true, and we go on. Yes?
Why is B not the normal H? It seems like H should be, the big H over there should be H effective here, and B should be H.
B is H effective. It is the total average field produced by all the particles in the system. I have a hunk of metal. B is not just the field produced by the wires around one. Here's a hunk of metal. The wires going around it. B is not just the field produced by the wires going around it. It is also the field that we calculate from the produced by the motion of the electrons within the metal. H effective is not just here. H effective is not just the field applied from outside. It is the average field produced by all the other guys. But those two calculations have the same concept.
But B is like the field in a vacuum, isn't it?
If you have a vacuum, it is the field in a vacuum. If you have a material, it is the field of the material. And you calculate it as the average field produced by all the other particles in the material. You calculate the currency of the material, and then you calculate that average field. Now, just because you did something wicked in your previous courses, you don't have to do the same wicked thing here. But you did it before, and I'm going to make you do it again, at least look at the slides, doing it again. However, here it says what you're doing. Mean field theory says the spin moves in the average field produced by all the other spins. But the actual value of these, I guess, but the actual value of the field is often larger in magnitude than the mean value and fluctuates in sign. The net result of all this is an error. The error has an unknown sign and an unknown magnitude. Same ideas can be applied to lots of problems. In particle physics, mean field theory often goes with the word one loop approximation or tadpole diagram. Mean field theory gives an interesting and instructive theory of phase transitions, but one which is only partially right. near the critical point for lower dimensional systems, including the three dimensions. Fluctuations dominate the system behavior, and mean field theory gives it a wrong answer, badly wrong. Very near first order phase transitions, fluctuations also count, but no less obvious matter. However, in high dimensions, usually about four, mean field theory gives a good picture of phase transitions. It also points, has features which point the way to the right theory, pretty simple to use. What we often do in all parts of physics is set up models which are partially correct. We then calculate. We work ourselves for hours and days and weeks and years in calculating the result of those models. Those models are not truth. Those models are just our best picture that we have for today of what we can do. Okay, let's calculate the results of mean field theory. I calculate mean field theory, the magnitude of a sigma at high temperatures and small couplings by using Newton's method, starting from sigma is equal to magnetic field. I then increase K step by step at fixed H and find sigma at each step by using the last step as the starting point for Newton's method. Here I'm just telling you the numerical method by which I solve the mean field equations. I then calculate minus beta times the free energy using the fact that the derivative with respect to H of minus beta F is sigma, and then the known values of free energy at high temperatures and small fields and small couplings. One of the useful results that emerges from this numerical calculation is the value of the coupling, which produces the first splitting in the H equals zero magnetization curves. This bifurcation occurs at Kz equals one. I'll show you in a picture in a second. Consequently, we evaluate this value, we identify this value of K where the bifurcation occurs, I'll show you a picture, as the critical value. Since K is a physical coupling strength divided by temperature, we can write K times Z in terms of the temperature and the critical temperature. This is a Z, I'm sorry, as KZ is TC over T. That's just to explain what occurs in the next picture. The next picture, no. Okay. Here is a picture involving TC over T, which is KZ. Horace. Okay. I pick up next time. Sorry to have gotten so enthusiastic. Don't want to steal our lunch. I pick up next time from this picture and tell you what mean field theory gives us. I will then tell you what's wrong with mean field theory little by little, and give you a better picture of phase transitions. But the one of the things I want to leave you with is this thing that you don't want to believe, the thing that none of you really feel great about, the notion that physics is something that happens in our heads. You can argue with me about that, but I surely believe that that's true. Lunchtime. Questions, comments, anybody? Okay, lunchtime.